Good morning. This is Northern Light for Wednesday, September 15th. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe.
Despite attempts to expand broadband coverage to rural areas, the state controller says thousands of North Country residents still don't have internet access. Several lawmakers who serve remote parts of the state say the pandemic only magnifies the inequities.
People hovered outside libraries and coffee houses into the wee hours just to borrow the Wi-Fi. And those struggling with emotional or mental health issues tried to make connections through spotty Zoom, which is a pretty tragic image.
New York State wants to cut funding for some people with disabilities if they don't move to the Sunmount Treatment Center in Tupper Lake. We talk with an investigative reporter in Albany who says many are upset given Sunmount's reputation.
You can imagine the hesitancy of a parent with a high needs child who is faced with putting them in this facility that's surrounded by a chain link fence and has a reputation for having sex offenders.
Also, a federal judge has blocked New York's medical worker vaccine mandate. And the latest Siena College poll shows most New Yorkers favor COVID vaccines and wearing masks. All of that's coming up on Northern Light. Stick with us.
Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by attorney Amy L. Smith, Lake Placid, advising Adirondack Farm, Forest, Camp landowners for the next generation of stewardship, 518-523-4580, and St. Joseph's Addiction Treatment and Recovery Centers, celebrating 50 years of healing individuals, reuniting families, and strengthening communities, stjoestreatment.org.
This is Northern Light. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe. A federal judge in Utica says New York State's requirement for healthcare workers to get vaccinated for COVID-19 must allow for religious exemptions. Ryan Finnerty reports.
17 anonymous healthcare workers filed a lawsuit against top New York officials, arguing their sincere religious beliefs compel them to refuse COVID-19 vaccines. A state mandate requiring all healthcare workers get vaccinated is set to take effect on September 27th. The judge's temporary order did not throw out that mandate, but says, for now, the state must allow employers to grant exemptions to the policy based on religious beliefs. Last week, a hospital in Lewis County announced it will pause maternity care services after several staff members resigned in opposition to the vaccine mandate. Ryan Finnerty, North Country Public Radio.
Later this morning on Point, we'll zoom out to the federal level and take a closer look at the Biden administration's vaccine mandates and their impact on public health. That's coming up between 10 and 11 o'clock here on NCPR. Meanwhile, here in the North Country, another 250 new COVID-19 cases were reported. Public health officials continue to say the Delta variant is driving the spread, and getting vaccinated reduces the risk of catching the virus and getting severely ill.
The North Country still has the highest positive COVID-19 test rate in the state at 5.65%. That's compared to the state wide average of 3.16%. A 93-year-old at a skilled nursing facility in Washington County died due to COVID-19. The person was fully vaccinated. Of Washington and Warren counties, 27 new cases, about a third had been vaccinated.
And in Franklin County, 50 children have tested positive for COVID-19 over the last week and a half. But a new poll out from Siena College shows that New Yorkers strongly support school districts requiring masks for students and staff in schools. Siena pollster Steve Greenberg says the poll says those surveyed supported masking in schools by a 78% to 18% margin. Greenberg also says the poll shows that New Yorkers strongly support masking in general.
When we asked how it's going to affect you, you know, do you support businesses like gyms or restaurants requiring their customers to show proof of vaccination? Two-thirds, 66% to 32%, say yes, they support it. Masks, 74% of voters say they support governments requiring masks in indoor settings.
The new Siena poll also asked people about their impression of Governor Kathy Hochul. They gave Hochul a 42% favorability rating 3 weeks after she took office, but almost the same amount say they don't know enough about her to have an opinion. 17% of New Yorkers have an unfavorable view of Hochul. Siena pollster Steve Greenberg says in terms of Hochul's plan to run for a full term as governor next year, her main issue right now is that a lot of New Yorkers just don't know a lot about her.
I would anticipate more and more voters will get to know her over the coming weeks and months and will have an opinion about her. What that says about the 2022 gubernatorial election, I think it's still way too early to know.
The new Siena poll also showed former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who resigned in August with his worst ever favorability rating from voters. 55% of New Yorkers gave him an unfavorable rating.
New York State is threatening to cut their funding for some people with disabilities if they don't move to a treatment facility in Tupper Lake. That's according to a new investigation by the Albany Times-Union. The Sunmount Development Center houses people with disabilities, but it also is home to people convicted of crimes and those who are unfit to stand trial.
Parents of people with disabilities are upset because of Sunmount's reputation, how remote it is, and how much of an institutional feel it has. Emily Russell spoke with the paper's investigative editor, Brendan Lyons, who says the state may be forcing people with disabilities to move to Sunmount as a cost-saving measure.
So you spoke to a few families who were told they had to send their kids to Sunmount, the Sunmount Center, or risk losing funding for long-term care. Can you just start by telling me a little bit about one of the families you talked to whose kid is Joseph Atkinson? Can you tell me about Joseph?
So Joseph has autism, and he has also some other conditions associated with autism, and he acts out. His parents had struggled to find integrated classrooms and schools for him, and he could certainly not do well in a typical classroom. And so he ended up attending about 12 different schools in New York until the state determined there were no other schools available that would admit him. So they ended up taking him to the Judge Rotenberg Center near Boston, Massachusetts. And the parents have described in letters that they wrote to the governor, Governor Cuomo, in July, that he had remarkable success at that facility.
What happened when Joseph aged out of that Massachusetts school?
Parents received a letter, and the timing is critical here. They were facing a June 30th deadline, which is when he would have his due process rights kick in. And the due process rights means that the parents would have a legal right to have a stakehold in the place where he would go. So the Office for People with Developmental Disabilities sent them a letter a couple weeks before the deadline to say that New York will not pay for him to reside out of state. And they gave his packet to residential facilities across the state, and each one of them, according to the parents, rejected him. And so OPWDD said, your choice is to bring him to Sunmount if you want the state to pay cost.
What are parents telling you about why they're hesitant to send their kids there?
Well, you can imagine the hesitancy of a parent with a high needs child who is faced with putting them in this facility that's surrounded by a chain link fence and has a reputation for having sex offenders and others, even if they're kept separately, they're still within that institution there. And that unsettles the parents, notwithstanding the fact that they might need to drive hours and hours just to visit their sons.
Lawmakers have written this letter to Governor Hochul. What's the hope that the new administration does with this situation?
What the lawmakers are asking for first is that these placements for those about to age out be halted until administrative and legislative changes can be implemented. And they want these assurances that these children are not intentionally or unintentionally, as they said, it's stripped of their due process rights. And in the interim, they've also asked that the funding for them to remain in their out-of-state facilities remain in place until they work this out.
What has the state said in response to the families and to your reporting?
You know, the state has kind of said that if there's no placement available in New York at the time of students' graduation, they have limited authority on an emergency basis to fund placement at out-of-state school. And that's only until adult placement in New York State is available. So the underlying issue here may be that New York does not have enough adequate residential programs to handle people like Joseph who have extremely high needs.
That was Brendan Lyons, investigative editor for the Albany Times-Union. He spoke with Emily Russell.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. It is 11 minutes past 8. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Stick around. We'll hear from a Russian-born flamenco guitarist performing in Keene Valley Saturday night. That conversation coming up in just a few minutes right here on Northern Light.
This is music by Wickmore Jazz Trio in Plattsburgh. Northern Light is supported by the Austable River Association, monitoring lakes and streams and finding solutions that reduce road salt pollution. Learn more at AustableRiver.org and Fort DLM Presentacion, helping to educate and recreate historical ventures of interest to the St. Lawrence region. Fort1749.org.
Potsdam Central School District is delayed 1 hour this morning after a special education teacher died yesterday afternoon. According to North Country Now, high school teachers will share brief information about what facts are known surrounding the death of Chris Dona. Superintendent Joanne Chambers says, quote, "The entire school community mourns this tragic loss." Chambers says significantly impacted families should reach out to their child's principal and counselors.
An advocacy group says the labor shortage across the economy is becoming especially acute at nursing homes and long-term care facilities. Marcella Goheen, founder of Essential Care Visitor, says longtime nursing home workers are exhausted from the pandemic. And with the minimum wage up to $15 an hour in many places, new workers are finding less demanding work elsewhere.
So what happens is the next generation comes in on the job, and they see how hard it is, and they work for 3 days, and they can get another job at the Burlington Coat Factory for just as much money without having to be responsible for 20 people's lives on a floor.
Goheen's calling on Governor Hochul's administration to force nursing homes to be more transparent about their staffing ratios and come up with a plan to recruit new professional caregivers.
A new report by the state controller finds that despite years of government programs, 1 million households in New York still have no access to the internet. The North Country was the region with the most people who had no internet access, about 5% of the population. That means about 21,000 people. The report found many in rural areas have limited access to internet services and that those that exist are often inadequate. Karen DeWitt reports from Albany.
Controller Tom DiNapoli says the 1 million homes without broadband represent 14% of the state's households. Many of them earn less than $20,000 a year.
There still is a digital divide, particularly in rural parts of the state, and for lower-income New Yorkers who don't have access or can't afford a home subscription.
Others can't get access to high-speed internet services. The report finds that many predominantly rural areas remain underserved, with either no availability of cable or fiber optic network services or access to just one company. The controller spoke at a bipartisan event in the city of Hudson in rural Columbia County. Assemblymember Dee Dee Barrett, who represents the region, says the COVID-19 pandemic-related lockdowns magnified the inequities in broadband access.
Households juggled as multiple family members suddenly tried to log on at the same time for work and for school. People hovered outside libraries and coffee houses into the wee hours just to borrow the Wi-Fi. And those struggling with emotional or mental health issues like isolation or substance abuse tried to make connections through spotty Zoom therapy and AA meetings, which is a pretty tragic image.
Existing programs have had some success. New York contracted with private companies to expand services, and the federal government has provided over 326,000 households with $50 a month subsidies to purchase internet services. But the report finds that many obstacles remain. Cable and fiber optic companies have been unwilling to install service on country roads, requiring that homeowners pay thousands of dollars to finance the hookups. Also, they say the Federal Communications Commission significantly undercounts the number of households that have access to high-speed internet. The FCC uses census data that concludes if one house on a block has high-speed internet, then all of the houses on the block have access. Assemblywoman Barrett says that's meaningless in rural areas where a block can be miles long and contain long stretches of woods or fields between houses. DiNapoli says the state needs to craft a detailed strategy to identify exactly where the access to services are lacking and whether the people who live there need subsidies to pay for an internet service. He says the state has taken in $5 billion more in sales and income tax and other revenues than originally projected, and perhaps some of those funds could be used to increase broadband access. Senator Daphne Jordan, who represents rural regions in eastern New York, says the state can also work to eliminate barriers that make it harder for smaller internet providers to fill the gap. Utility companies like National Grid require the internet providers to pay for poles that are in disrepair. The state also charges right-of-way fees on state highways to internet service providers.
When a utility company tells them, you can use our pole, but you need to replace it because it's in disrepair, they can't afford to do that. When the state imposes the tax on the right-of-way for fiber optic, that makes it unaffordable.
Jordan says tax credits could also be used. They say there are funds remaining in the state's portion of the COVID relief measures passed by Congress. They hope some of that money could be used for extending broadband services. Also, the House and Senate are considering a $3.5 trillion infrastructure package that includes money for broadband. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. In just a minute, music and conversation with a top-notch flamenco guitarist. After that, stick around for news headlines from NPR at 8:30. Right now, it's 64 degrees in Paul Smith's and in Boonville, 63 degrees in Lion Mountain, 20 degrees Celsius in Brockville. Cloudy skies in the forecast today with a chance of thunderstorms throughout the area. Highs around 70 degrees. But skies should be brightening up by tomorrow and as we head into the day on Friday. Well, one of the world's best flamenco guitarists is coming to the Adirondacks this weekend. Russian-born flamenco guitarist virtuoso Grisha Guryachev brings his brand of traditional and modern flamenco guitar to a concert this Saturday night at the Keene Valley Congregational Church beginning at 7:30. He'll also present a flamenco workshop for music students at Keene Valley Central School. And starting his concert career at age 9 in St. Petersburg, Russia, Guryachev has revived flamenco classics and mastered the great modern flamenco style of Paco de Lucia.
Grisha immigrated to the U.S. in the late 90s. He received a doctorate in music at the New England Conservatory in classical guitar performance, and he's given performances and workshops across the world. And I caught up with him via Zoom to hear some of his music and talk with him about flamenco guitar. When I hear the word flamenco, I have to be honest, I think about Spanish flamenco dance. I'm wondering, do you think that people sometimes don't quite understand what flamenco guitar is? I mean, does it sort of bridge classical guitar and jazz, or is, you know, it's its own genre? How do you define flamenco guitar?
It's a very difficult question. But you're absolutely right about flamenco being the dance first. It's actually a dance and song. Guitar came to flamenco later. So it started out as just dancing and singing and maybe accompaniment of maybe hand claps or something like that. And guitar came into flamenco later to just support the dancing and the singing. So for the song, it provided the harmonic support. And by way of strumming the strings, it imitated the rhythmical accompaniment that, you know, people would expect from clapping, for example. The guitar is not a very loud instrument, and if you ever see flamenco dancing or singing, hear the singing, you would instantly experience that power. So it's very loud, right? There is a lot of energy. The singing almost feels like screaming of the soul, and the footwork of the dancers is deafening, especially on the wooden floor. So guitar had to cut through that noise. And become part of the group. And that's why guitarists use a lot of strumming. So this strumming is very advanced and very rhythmical, and there's lots of syncopation and different ways of strumming. So there's a wide palette of possible sounds. Flamenco guitar is played more like a percussive instrument rather than a melodic instrument, but it can also have melodies in between. It just it's a little bit of a denser texture, I guess, than a classical guitar. And flamenco players care less about the quality of the sound and more about the rhythm, the rhythmical precision in their playing.
I love that description that you're sort of, in some ways, as the guitarist, you are kind of performing a dance in a way with, like you say, the percussive sounds and that sort of thing. I just love that.
Yeah, that's, that kind of boils my blood also. Uh-huh.
So tell us a bit about the concert coming up in the Adirondacks. What will you be playing? What are you excited to share?
I'm going to be playing some of my favorites. I will start with older style flamenco. So you will probably hear Malagueña, by Ernesto Licona, transcribed by Paco de Lucia in his own flamenco way. And then I will play the modern style flamenco, so including Vicente Amigo and Gerardo Núñez, which are great guitarists and musicians. And also you will hear all the syncopation that I'm talking about in the music of Paco de Lucia. In his later pieces, he really explored that in depth. You know, flamenco is not really a rumba, you know, like soft listening kind of, I would say, Gypsy Kings type of music. Mm-hmm. And it's also not a style from Latin America. It sounds very different. There's a different sentiment in it. There is a little bit more of sadness, you know, in it, I would say, and a little bit more energy. I call it the music of the earth. Now, as far as the common mispronunciation of flamenco, some people say it's flamingo music, but it's really, there is no relation to the bird. So it's kind of cute in a way.
That's right. Two different things, a bird and music. Yeah, right.
two very, very beautiful things, right. I would say.
Right, exactly. Flamenco guitar virtuoso Grisha Goryachev brings his brand of traditional and modern flamenco guitar to a concert this Saturday night at the Keene Valley Congregational Church, starting at 7:30. It's sponsored by East Branch Friends of the Arts. Suggested donation is $10. Students are free, and remember to wear a mask and provide proof of vaccination.
If you're going to be in the Queensbury area this evening, join the Warren County Historical Society for an evening of historic Americana songs on mandolin and banjo. The music group, the Lost Radio Rounders, is based in the Capital Region and is performing tonight. Tisha Dalton is with the Historical Society and says the Radio Rounders show is a perfect for homeschool groups, American history buffs, and fans of gospel music.
They have the typical, like, you know, folk duo kind of banter back and forth, and they talk about history in between the songs. And they have lots of different themes. There's a lot of presidential campaign songs. They run the gamut from, like, God Save George Washington and Jimmy Polk of Tennessee, Hurrah for Grant, and then the very whimsical When Grover's Term Comes to an End about Grover Cleveland. Kind of like political cartoons, but in song. That's kind of what they are.
He will win election day as he holds the polls at bay. We all will cheer to hear the happy news. He will oust the traitor horde with a ballot as his sword. The Ku Klux Klan will shiver in their shoes. Red, the country's calling. Goodbye, and he must go. For the mantle the our head on to victory is led. For Grant, a traitor ever is a foe.
And then thrown in, there are other, like, social movement kind of songs incorporated. So there's, you know, abolition songs, temperance, labor songs. There's a suffrage song, which is my personal favorite. Unfortunately, I tend to be the youngest one in the audience, so I'd really prefer not to be there. I get really excited when we have young folks there. You get the random kid who's interested in politics at 10 years old. So
it looked like they play the banjo, the mandolin, among many,
yeah,
many Dobro, other.
Yeah, they play tons of things. It's pretty awesome.
And you mentioned it, but what's your favorite song that they do?
Oh, they do a suffrage song, and it's called Oh Dear, What Can the Matter Be? I personally do similar kind of programs, but more history-oriented, but I do sing songs in between. And my focus is local suffrage research, so like Warren and Washington County suffrage. And the suffrage songs are typically popular songs of the day with new lyrics. So at suffrage meetings, they could hand out the lyric sheets and just say, we're going to be singing this to the tune of Yankee Doodle. So people could sing along.
And a lot of these songs that they're doing are the same kind of thing. So, you know, they might have a campaign song that was set to a popular tune of the day so they could just hand out the new song words and people could then just write up and sing along. It was really easy for people to participate instead of just composing like a new piece. That's what kind of makes this fun is people are like, oh, I know this song. You know, it's like once they get into the groove, they can kind of, you know, sing along with the chorus if they've heard it a couple of times.
Wait, and you're kind of burying the lead here. You do this kind of thing too?